This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
This is the Book Riot Podcast. I'm Jeff O'Neill.
And I'm Rebecca Shinsky.
And we're recording today on Thursday, February 29th, 2024. We're talking about bookshop, thinking about maybe getting into the audiobook industry, a giant survey of publishing diversity, a really interesting, and we could do a whole show about the state of culture, Ted Joya's semi-viral amongst the intellectual knowledge working class of the Substack forward internet, I would say, at this point. And then some book news stuff to do. So a slam bang show all of a sudden, Rebecca.
Yeah,
it turned into kind of a slow one to a hot one.
A good old-fashioned Book Riot podcast variety hour.
Yeah, it really does. Before we get started on that, news and notes. Let's see, of late, where can you find us elsewhere? I completed my ranking of the top 20 winners
The
Academy Award for Adapted Screenplay this week on the Deep Dive. So I looked at the last 20 winners and ranked them from 20 to number one. Did you have a chance to look at that at all? I think maybe
I did.
Yeah.
Yeah, I did. I read it. I read both parts. It was really interesting. Went into some of my own thinking about prep for next week's bonus episode.
Yep.
Or no, next week's just regular Wednesday episode, in which we're going to be trying to predict the winner of this year's Best Adapted Screenplay.
Equipped to talk about this year than I'd done most of these over time. I will get to almost every nominee eventually in Adapted Screenplay, my favorite category, for reasons that maybe are self-evident at this point. Rebecca did a roundup of friendship-related books for Better Living Through Books. You can check that out there. There'll be links to all this stuff in the show notes. Our most recent Patreon episode was what? What was our most recent Patreon? Was that Deals, Deals, Deals?
Deals, Deals, Deals.
Okay. Yeah. There was a preview there, Today in Books, all the things that are going on there. We're going to be recording after this for the next members only episode. Our thoughts on Kelly Link's The Book of Love, the first big anticipated book of the year. Did I get that right? Was there something before that? I think this is it. I think this was the first one.
This is it. This was the first one, yeah.
There's a lot coming, and we're going to dive deep into it. Lots to talk about there. So that's kind of what's going on here. Before that, let's do our first sponsor and get into the news.
Today's episode is brought to you by Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us. When the life Soledad Barnes built with the man who was supposed to be her forever goes poof in a cloud of betrayal and disillusion, there is no time to pout or sulk or even grieve the life she lost. But then an unlikely man enters the picture. He's the forbidden one, the one she shouldn't want but can't seem to resist. Y'all know how that goes. But Soledad's lost it all before and refuses to repeat her mistakes. She asks herself, can she trust him? Can she trust herself? From the ashes of a life burned to the ground, something bold and new can rise. So This Could Be Us is an instant New York Times and USA Today bestseller. It's been featured on the Today Show and CBS Mornings. And Kennedy Ryan is the first Black romance author to hit the New York Times adult bestseller list in almost 3 years, which is amazing. Make sure to check out the new book. And thanks again to Forever and Kennedy Ryan's heart-searing sensual This Could Be Us for sponsoring this episode. Today's episode is brought to you by Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publisher of the smash hit Fourth Wing. You'll only cross these blades once in a page-turning new tale of revenge, strategy, and so many lies. Best-selling Red Tower Books is releasing its next irresistible read that will capture your imagination and keep you guessing until the end. Mae Corlin's Five Broken Blades tells an intricate, high-stakes tale of five total strangers united in a plot that will test their strength, wits, and courage. Each has their reasons, all have secrets. But while it's easy to betray a stranger, it's not so simple to stab a friend or a lover, okay, in the back. Now these five blades must choose between vengeance and one another. Pick up Five Broken Blades by Mae Corlin for a thrilling, adventurous tale filled with risk, romance, adventure, and oh, so many lies. The relationships in it are complex and nuanced and involve everything from friends to enemies, found and biological family and lovers and more. Thanks again to Entangled Publishing's Red Tower Books, publishers of the smash hit Fourth Wing, for sponsoring this episode.
We also have In the Club, the newsletter. I should mention this now. Recommendations of best books discussed for your book club. So if you have a book club, a lot of you do, you go to bookriot.com/in the club to sign up. bookriot.com/in the club. Also a link in the show notes there. Bookshop.org appears to be interested in audiobooks. So this is me getting a survey from bookshop.org about my audiobooks habits. And so I linked to it in Today in Books. That's fair, right? If they're sending a survey about my listening habits as a bookshop.org sometimes customer, why else would you be doing this, right, Rebecca? I mean, that's not fair. It's not unfair to say.
It's not a secret that they're gathering this information. I would imagine that most bookshop customers who got this survey had the same thought, whether they work in the industry or not. So, yeah, I think it's fair to say it happened and you have thoughts about it and I have thoughts about it. And this seems like reasonable speculation. Why are you asking people about their audiobook usage if you are not considering attempting to become part of their audiobook usage?
Yeah, and they asked, I think this link is publicly available, so I'll put in the show notes if you want to go fill it out. You know, do you listen to audiobooks? Which provider do you use? Why do you use that provider? Do you do pay-as-you-go or subscribe? How many? Do you also buy other stuff? You know, all the kind of stuff. I guess there's a couple things I'm surprised they didn't ask is about pricing, I guess, but maybe they can find that secondarily. And I think how many books you listen to, a book a week, one book a month, or a book every few months, and it varies, was not, I felt like that spread was wrong.
About
how to do that.
I have some research design notes that the people at bookshop.org did not ask me for, but I don't think that's the most helpful spread of options in that question for getting a sense of who your customer base is. There was a, do you also buy print books or ebooks? Select all that apply. And there's a print books, ebooks, audio only, and then an all. There are better ways to ask that as well. But yeah, there's a couple things here where I'm concerned they might not get like terribly clear data, but I also suspect that if the first gate is just, are we going to do this or not?
Yes.
You really only need the answers to a couple of these questions. And they can probably surmise that. And I mean, they really only need the answer to one, which is, would you be likely to buy audiobooks from bookshop.org in the future? And again, the only three options they offered, though, are very likely, not very likely, and undecided.
And without knowing pricing and everything else, I think that's hard to do.
How can you know?
I was even trying to think, so what outcomes here would be go, no go for launch, right? Because if they're emailing bookshop.org current members and I say yes or no to listen to audiobooks, I'm not sure I do with that data, right? Because if it's no, then maybe I can turn some people around. And if it's yes, that means I got to convert them to some other place. So I'm not really sure. I guess you want to see and just see what your opportunity is. Like, and do they think the bookshop.org cohort has different audiobook preferences in terms of provider than anybody else? I guess if they see and more people have selected Libro FM than it would say from a Bayesian prior, that would not surprise me because Libro FM is targeted at the people who want to buy audiobooks, but not from a giant tech company, which is kind of your only choice here. So that's one.
I think there's a place here for a question like, what would make you interested or willing to become a bookshop.org audiobooks customer? And that would be something like, it's cheaper than Audible, or it's not Amazon and I like that, or maybe it needs to be cheaper than Audible and cheaper than Libro, or it needs to have a bigger catalog, or it needs to be pay as you go rather than credits. Like, there are a lot of secondary things. I think this is an interesting entrance into exploring this space. I hope that they are collecting additional data beyond this survey to make this decision.
I almost don't know if you need any data. I mean, I guess that's where I am with this. Like, if you think it's a good idea, and maybe they're trying to think about that, audiobooks are the fastest growing part of the publishing industry, and long has been a thorn in the side of independent bookstores because Kobo and Libro have some dope stuff, but all the reasons that bookshop.org exists trebly for audiobooks. It's all the same problems, but even worse, I think, for independent bookstores and audiobooks. So
it's the fastest growing, and it's the least used of the formats between print, ebook, and audio. So there's the most ceiling. So yeah, I agree with that. I think that there are presumably folks who are possible to convert to audiobook listeners who have not been converted, and they might not be able to articulate in advance what would make them try. Generally, consumers are terrible at telling you what they want or how they will make a decision. Like, just sort of, and that includes us. Like, just people are bad at this. Behavioral economics or economicists know this. That I think, Bookshop could just say, we think there's still space here. We've seen it with Spotify. They thought there was room.
Yes.
They've built it into the premium offering. And both Spotify and publishers have confirmed that that has resulted in growth. Publishers are seeing new revenue because audiobooks are available on Spotify. So it's not just cannibalizing from the other audiobook providers. And I think a bookshop.org offering would do the same thing. There would be some kind of growth. There would be somebody who's like, I've never paid for audiobooks, but let me try this. Maybe there are folks just using their library for audiobooks right now because they don't want to be in.
I thought that was another one. Why not talk about, ask them? You would think the indie bookstore Denizen would also be,
you know,
a frequenter of library lending and using Libby.
I think it might be an implicit assumption that a library user is using the library because they can't or won't pay for the product.
I think that's a dumb assumption if that's what their assumption is.
I agree.
I do it all the time.
I agree.
And it's like it's a part of the mix.
But it is notably missing from the survey, any mention of library usage at all. And I think it's very possible that there are, we know from Book Riot customer research and our audience polls that folks use the library and buy books. Most readers are doing both. There are some who exclusively buy, there are some who exclusively borrow, but most folks do both. So you could maybe convert some of those library users who haven't wanted to be in with Audible, or they have, you know, they don't care about Spotify or whatever, but they're already given money to Bookshop because they're getting this bookshop.org survey.
Right.
And you could say, what if we also had audio for you? That might make it easier. You wouldn't have to wait the way you wait for your library. I do think that's an oversight to not at least explore audio. Like, if you're going to survey folks, instead of just deciding we think there's opportunity here and going for it, you need to ask about the whole landscape of places people can access books.
Tough beat for Barnes & Noble not to be included on that audiobook provider.
Yeah.
Apple, too, noted. That was like BookBeat I'd never heard of. So maybe there's a giant underground. Or not, maybe it's overground. I could have just missed it completely. You know, connecting a couple dots here, we know that ebooks are coming to bookshop.org. I don't think I know if it's going to be a dedicated app or how they're going to do that. It almost have to be because DRM of the case. Now, if you have an app where people can read digital material, adding an audiobook tab or selection would not be, it would make for an interesting digital buying experience, right?
Yeah.
You could select in the app, you know, I want to support the Raven Bookstore in Lawrence, Kansas, or wherever you want. And then you could just go that through the Kobo thing. In the old days, you had to select it and use a code, and it could be durable for a while, but it would break all the time. It was well-intentioned and poorly executed. But this one sort of, if you're going to break the dam on selling non-physical books, go all the way. Do audiobooks too. Do digital.
Yeah, I agree.
Just make it right there, right in the thing, and do it. The other advantage of both ebooks, I don't know if it's an advantage, it's less of a disadvantage than Bookshop was already swinging against, which is in terms of pricing. Like the audiobook, ebooks, listen, as much as I hate ebook pricing, they're at least bad everywhere, right? You're not because of the nature of how those lawsuits went down. And audiobook pricing is like ebook pricing, but worse if such thing was possible. Mm-hmm. So there's a chance just to be like, treat me like an adult and charge me $19.99 or whatever per audiobook. Like, pick your spot and go. And you can be at least as bad as everyone else. And that's an advantage when your pitch is not price. And also you don't have a selection problem because you get them from the same providers. So then bookshop's pitch is actually clearer about being about moral or shop local to support your local, because it costs me nothing to do it because I'm not paying a premium to do so by buying a more expensive book than I would if I was going through Amazon or someplace else. You have price parity. So it makes a ton of sense there. And ebooks and audiobooks together are like 66% of the dollars in books. So I'm not surprised. I hope there's potential for feather ruffling amongst the industry, but you know, that could be interesting.
I think we gotta ruffle more feathers. I would like to see more feathers ruffled more of the time in the industry when there's opportunity to grow the way that people who want to buy books can buy them in any format.
Also got me wondering about bookshop.org's demographics. Like, who is the median? Have they regressed to the mean of American book buyers of like 44-year-old white women? I wouldn't be surprised.
Or the mean of American indie bookstore shoppers.
Which is what? Do we even know? Also, 44-year-old white women who live in Philadelphia suburbs?
My mental model is a slightly higher economic band than general book buyers, because you're typically paying full price or a very low discount at an indie bookstore.
I think it's a shame for them that they didn't get ahead of the Spotify things. Like, I think Spotify has legs, and I think
so too.
Emerging as the second competitor to Audible, which no one really had, is in play for Spotify. I don't think there's a chance of knocking Audible off the throne anytime soon, but it's kind of interesting to see there.
And it's interesting too. Like, there are plenty of folks who wanted Libro or something like Libro FM to exist. I don't think that Libro FM has reached anywhere near the fullness of what like consumer outreach, marketing, advertising, whatever you want to call it, could look like. There are still tons of, you know, book reading, audiobook listening civilians in my life who mention Audible and that they would like to get away from Amazon and are like deeply delighted and surprised that Libro FM exists. And those people have been giving money on Al Gore's internet to online shop to the big bad, and they're interested. They're not interested enough to Google audiobook that isn't from Audible, you know, to get themselves to Libro FM. So go out and reach them, and that means there's opportunity here for Bookshop, especially if they would aggressively market this, because I've been a fan of Libro FM. I use it. There's, you know, interesting partnerships there as well. Like, I'm using most of these: Spotify, Libro, Audible. They're kind of all in the mix now. But there is opportunity here to aggressively market to audiobook consumers who don't want to be giving their money to Audible. And maybe you've got issues with Spotify and you don't want to be giving your money to Spotify or to another giant corporation.
Right.
Bookshop has that B Corp, you know, social mission stuff built in. Just like lean in to the messaging of it and go for those customers. Like, I think that if Libro had successfully reached the consumers who want an alternative to an Amazon-owned audiobook company, this wouldn't be an option that's available to Bookshop, or it wouldn't look so appealing. But Libro has left a lot of money.
Or they'd have to buy them or merge.
They've left a lot of money on the table.
Yeah, if Libro was more dominant, they'd have bookstores participate with Libro, and Libro has grown. So if this is you got to choose us or them to do your audiobook fulfillment, or you're going to make your customers, like maybe you have a Libro code and a Bookshop code for your customers to buy their audiobooks. It's possible, right? Like, it's been a while since I looked at Libro, but I go to Powell's all the time. And I don't know if Powell's hasn't signed up for a Libro affiliate, whatever, or it's either that or they haven't marketed, because there's no sign. There should be. And I do wonder how much print bookstores are actually interested even in promoting the partnership they do have with an audiobook platform, right? Because from the seller's point of view, from Bookshop's point of view, you're price competitive with other retailers, but from a indie bookseller's point of view, you're looking at format wars. You're like, wait a minute, do I want to profit from someone who sells something that I don't sell? and this could go away and they're habituated to buying audiobooks from this platform? Because you don't get to keep that relationship if they decide to cut you off or change the terms or other things.
There's real competing incentives. I think starting with a partnership with indie bookstores is a great way for these companies that aren't Amazon to start to reach customers. But if that's where it stops, you're leaving a lot of potential customers on the table. If it's only like we're advertising ourselves through our partnerships with indie bookstores, and then anybody who does care enough to Google for alternatives to Audible, there are just a ton of readers who would be quite delighted to learn that Libro is a thing, or that bookshop.org is a thing, and that they support indie bookstores, and that you can do it without like leaving the comfort of your couch and still get the audiobooks that you want. There's a lot of opportunity here. I really hope Bookshop will go for it.
Boy, how much did the ABA fumble the bag with online e-commerce? I mean, they own a piece of Bookshop, I think. They invested in some piece of it, but it's different than this, because all this, it's kind of a lesson in whether you like it or not, technological change or change anytime is going to come for your industry. And you can either be a part of it and shape it a little bit to your liking, or you can have something like this happens where someone who isn't as precious about your business model is going to come in and provide the solutions that people want. Yeah. It's tricky, I get it. And it's not easy to see the future by any stretch of the imagination. But you could imagine an ABA app that has audiobooks and ebooks with a very simple, like, put in your bookstore's code here, and 20, like, all the margin goes to that bookstore. God damn. Too bad.
It's a real missed, it's a missed opportunity, and it's, I don't think they'll ever catch up. Yeah.
Bookshop has been wonderful. Like I said in Today in Books, like, one of the real digital success stories of the bookish world, and I don't know that there are that many to count on. But outside of the big A's ecosystem, like, they've bought a lot of them. They bought Library Thing, and they own a big piece of, or they have a piece of AB, sorry, backwards. They own a piece of Library Thing. They own Goodreads. They own Audible. They own Comixology. They have a lot of, and of course, Kindle and the things, but Bookshop found a crack in the sidewalk, and it was more of a, it was a little bit more of a, it's more of a river than a crack. They seem to be doing quite well. So let's see, moving on from there, I guess other book, let's do industry news. Jesmyn Ward signs a 3-book deal with Scribner. Yes. Hooray, hooray, no surprise. The only additional thing I had to say about it was I have my eye on what is Simon doing, right, with the KKR overlords back there. You heard me talk last week about KKR, and is it steady as she goes? Are they going to come in there and shake things up and have super secret private equity knowledge? I think a 3-book deal with Scribner, which isn't the most literary, he says.
It is,
probably. Yeah, probably Simon. is of Simon Schuster. I mean, Jesmyn Ward's there, so wherever she is at Simon Schuster is automatically now the most literary imprint. A 3-book deal, book of essays soon, and then 2 novels later, same imprint, same editor. I'm assuming she got the kind of money she could get other places. This is not a revolutionary deal. It's an evolutionary deal, or sort of keeping the band together. I guess if they had signed a multi-year contract, or we got some sense that it was a lot more money, or if she had gone somewhere else, but this is no news means same news, I guess, when it comes to my sense here. Like, you know, KKR is going to trim the sails and try to do a couple things, and it's already profitable, and they'll spin it and for a 57% profit in 3 years, and that'll be it. But I'm happy. I don't want anything to rock my Jesmyn Ward boat.
Me neither.
So that's where I am.
I am very excited about what this tells us about what we can expect from the Jesmyn Ward boat.
Yeah.
Because it had been that the novels were coming many years apart. And like, I will wait as many years as Jesmyn Ward needs to write a novel.
Yep.
That's fine with me. We're not sending angry emails to authors that they're not going fast enough for us. But an essay collection in 2025 and then 2 novels in 2027 and 2029 is a cadence I can be very excited about. I love knowing that there's only going to be 4 years.
I wouldn't get
having
those release dates tattooed on your body, Rebecca.
I won't. Okay. I'm not sending her angry emails, but like,
no, I'm just saying, you know,
that
be
she's,
careful here.
Yeah. We won't get too attached, but the idea of like 4 years between Let Us Descend and whatever comes in 2027, and then only another 2 between that and 2029, even if those spread out more, it might be still a closer timeline than what we've had between her works of fiction, especially. Yeah. Like, I'm stoked for whatever. I'm here for the Jesmyn Ward essay collection. Just all the way. We're going to do an episode in a few weeks about, like, who are our auto-buy, yeah, insta-buy authors. Jesmyn Ward near the top of the list. But this was great news to me. I was having no KKR thoughts and a lot of, like, yes, just give me more Jesmyn Ward. I'm so glad for a three-book deal.
That's the headline. I think the subhead yeah, for me is, like, this is Scribner doubling down or yeah, extending into the next decade.
And there's Jesmyn no Ward info here. In the PW piece, they don't really traffic in the dollar signs unless it's released and it's really, really big. But I would assume
level they don't do that.
Yeah, this is also not a like. There's no way this is a small deal. No. So we're seeing that Simon and Schuster, Scribner, continuing to be allowed by their overlords to invest in big deals like this.
Good you go her. Into Simon Schuster offices and it's like. She's out. It's like her and King in terms of the titles they have face out in lobbies and stuff. And it makes yeah, sense. She's like, she's the standard bearer, not just for American letters, but certainly for Simon and Schuster. So I think they were wise to lock her up for a little while. Sidebar question. Something you said got me thinking of this question. What is the, let's say you are a ward level or ward aspirant writer of literary fiction. What is the ideal release cadence?
Oh.
Both so that you're out in the mix, but you are also it's a special deal when you have a new book. I think yearly, I guess all I'll say is yearly is too often.
Yeah.
That's
I
too
agree.
Much. Now, next, I'm not sure what the next cadence would be. If you have one every 2 years, that means every year you have either a hardback or a paperback. I think that might be too much still.
I think so. I think three is ideal
three.
That you get
three
like
three.
You get the hardcover with, for someone at Jesmyn Ward's level, somewhere yep, between, I don't know, 3, maybe 4 months of like big promotion after it. Mm-hmm. Like it, a lot of it is in the first couple of weeks, but she's still going to be, or she was, you know, still doing interviews several months after there's a lot of coverage. Then you get like to hang back and work on stuff while you wait for the paperback to come out. Mm-hmm. Then you go do some paperback promotion and you then put a bow on the next book. And it comes out in the third year. I think that's ideal. And that's about what we're seeing Colson Whitehead do every 2 to 3.
Yeah, the Carney stuff has been a little bit faster, but on the whole, that yeah, makes sense. Yeah, because if you're doing more than that, you really need to be doing a series where people are waiting on the next thing. I think more than that, and it can be hard to make it special. And I think making it a deal is part of the magic sauce here.
Yeah, there's some element of scarcity and yeah, this takes time to do well that's tied into like the high craft of literary fiction for sure.
Yeah. So in a 20-year career, well, it'd be longer, but like you're looking mm-hmm, at 10 novels every 30 years. So a young writer, they'll have 10 by the time they're in their mid-50s if they start pretty quick after their MFA, inevitable MFA. Like I'm just saying, there's all kinds of shapes. Like that's a
yeah,
pretty good...
I think,
to have 10 when you're by your mid-50s, that's a pretty good corpus.
Right. And I do think if you do 3 in your first 10 years,
yeah,
you're set up to, and they're good, and you have an established readership, then you have space to space them out more
yeah,
as you go on, because folks will wait then. They'll be invested. They've had enough, you know, successful visits to the Jesmyn Ward bank to be like, yes, you know, if she wants to space them out 4 or 5 years, cool. When there's like a sort of crash of a big novel by a big author where it's like, this is coming out in 3 months. Surprise! Mm. It's been 5 years since the last one. That's always really exciting. And I think publishers are thinking about that. Like, how yeah, do we keep this exciting? How do we keep it fresh? How do you also keep the shine on a special book yes, that you want people to think is special?
It's an event, right? Kind of, it's an event
yeah,
every 3 years. It comes
right,
out.
Kind of the inverse of what goes on in genre publishing, where like it is ideal if you're a romance writer that you can put out a book every 6 months.
Right.
Because that like that's how you keep a dedicated genre reader on the hook is mm-hmm, keep them interested. Like they need a fix and you want to be available to give them the fix. Cause if you're not, somebody else will.
Kelly wrote about the 25th anniversary of Perks of Being a Wallflower. And that was reminding me because Chbosky was like, it was like 10 years between books, like 20 Perks was his debut. And I think it was like 10 or more years until the second book came out. And especially if you're in young adult or kids, like your fans are old now. They're mm-hmm, 25, and the new 15-year-olds don't know who the hell you are. I think that's another one where more frequent helps you because you need to have your name be in the mix for teachers and educators, and also that you can get a couple of books into your, teenage fans, and maybe they'll pick you up as adults, or maybe you can go into adult fiction a little bit later. But that's another one where I think a faster cadence help you, because an adult has a longer life, right? I'm going to read Donna Tartt's new book, even though we're now, what, 10 years, right? But waiting 10 years as a 15-year-old for the new Chbosky, how many people are going to care by the time they're 25? Maybe some will, but it's not going to have the same thing. All right, let's do another story before the sponsor break. So Michael Threets, who had become the darling of the bookish internet, a ray of sunshine, a librarian at the Solano County Library in California, if you spend any time on your social video apps and you have any sort of book-related algorithm juice in your phone...
You've seen him.
Retiring, stepping down from his role at the library because of harassment, specifically on X/Twitter. Sucks, man. I hate to say I am not surprised that this is happening. One of the reasons that Book Riot does not have a face of our social video is because we've been doing social long enough to know stuff like this can happen. And frankly, I'm surprised he lasts as long as he did for as many views as these people get.
Yeah.
I don't know how the rank and file Bookstagrammer, BookTalker, I don't know what their harassment level looks like. I think one thing that's different about Michael is that he was in a specific location. His full name was out there. And people could harass differently. He had multiple attack surfaces, which sucks.
Yeah.
I hope he finds a landing place that can use his enthusiasm and charismatic warmth for good. I floated that maybe the American Library Association could use a head of social media. I'm not sure if anything they do now. But I'm not sure what else to say. I wish him really well, and I'm so sorry to see it. And this is the, dare I say, inevitable downside of getting to this level of exposure in these places.
Well, yeah, I think it doesn't have to be inevitable, but it has become inevitable because the platforms have very clearly made a choice to prioritize engagement over user safety. Yeah. And, everybody provides a blocking tool, whatever, but that doesn't prevent the harmful interaction from happening. It just gives you something to do after the harmful interactions. And if you're a public figure like he was, like we are, where there are other ways to reach you, maybe people can find your email address. This guy works in a library with a physical location where
you can go somebody and find
nutty
his body
who wanted to go find him could do it. And if you're listening to this and you've never had to deal with social media harassment, I am very, very glad for you. And it also means you haven't done math about things like, should I post on my Instagram that I practice at this yoga studio?
Right.
Should I post on my Instagram that I'm a member of this club or that I support this nonprofit or any of those other things that are just like normal parts of our lives, but that all have physical locations attached to them? And if I post that I'm part of this thing or I'm attending this event, I am telling the world where my body is going to be at a certain time. And when the world knows where you work in a publicly available physical location, that risk is even more elevated. Like, I think the real story is we're lucky we ever get to hear from anybody who does work like this. when this is an inevitable thing you're going to experience, and you don't have to get 745,000 followers and 15 million likes to get this. You just have to get one little bit of visibility or have the one wrong person find you among your 12 views, and you can experience horrible things. Like, this is real. We can get further into this, I guess, when we talk about the state of culture stuff, but this is a part of creating content and existing on the internet, as a content creator, as a public figure of any kind. Plenty of people who are just, living private citizen lives are experiencing it as well. And I don't see any end in sight to it, unless short of actual legislation.
Well, and I just don't know this has been a problem since, forever, really, when there's public figures that have haters, whether it's Sirhan or John Wilkes Booth, but this internet scale is a different situation, right?
Yeah.
And it doesn't. Who knows what these threats are and what they sounded like? But even having someone threaten you, and you know, and the math is that they probably aren't going to do anything, you still got to sleep at night with that. Like that's it's mm-hmm. It's not that like, well, he didn't ever get attacked. It's like you got to go to like. I'm telling tales out of school a little bit here, but like we have had offices mm-hmm. with a publicly available physical address, and some people don't like what we do, and they'll let us know. And I think about that. Someone could mail us an envelope full of white powder. It's very easy to do. It would stop mm-hmm. no one. There's nothing I can do about it. And we try to keep that stuff really on the DL, right? We try to keep that really low. And this sort of happened around him. He was in situ in this library trying to advocate, trying to inspire, trying to welcome and include. And probably, I don't know. I wonder at what point, it'd be interesting to hear him talk about his experience of this. I wonder if he'll give an interview or something like that at some point. At what point did it turn from, hey, I'm making some fun videos in the kids section, to that other thing? And that mm-hmm. other thing being someone saying something that made you think, huh, and then whoa. And then, oh no, and then I'm out here.
Yeah, and there's, this is mean, this is hurtful, and then there's, this feels dangerous to me. There's threatening, and there's just a place where enough mean, hurtful things add up to feeling dangerous. That's dangerous for your mental health. Like, you're not telling tales out of school. Like, that's a thing that has impacted all of us who have been here for a while. And in the, like, in the long run, I've had so many thoughts about, like, if I had known that my work was going to be, that my work on the internet was going to be this, that this is what the internet was going to turn into, really. That's it. If I had known that this is how the internet was going to be, I would have started my internet career with a different name. Like, I would work under a name that is not my name.
It's a thought.
In my real life.
That's a real thought.
And that would do some things, but it still wouldn't fully protect me, because people who want to figure things out can figure things out and come for you. But it's just, like, this is inevitable. It didn't have to be. But it is the way that it is on the internet now, and it would take really meaningful work and regulation to reverse it and prevent it. And the big platforms are not interested.
The horse is out of the bag. Like, I don't see how we go back.
No,
unfortunately. And it's all fun and games until it's not, right? And I just wonder about this. And it's super interesting. Like, well, let's do our sponsor break, and then let's talk about the culture piece, because I do think it plays into this a little bit.
Yeah, they're connected.
So I linked this the other day, and then you liked it well enough to share in our company Slack. I'm not surprised. We've been thinking about these things, mm-hmm. and this is a beautiful piece. I urge you to go read it. The Honest Broker is Ted Gioia's Substack, and he's doing a state of culture. And we don't want to go through, I could go through this beat by beat, honestly. Like, that would be a page.
Same.
Like, we could honestly go through this
beat by beat. We could do a long discussion of this.
I will give you my two big chunks, and then you can tell me if you want to go somewhere else or if that's your kind of the same thing. One is, I think that his phrase, the dopamine industrial complex, has legs mm-hmm. as an idea, as phraseology that could be turned into a book. You know, like, I would put it up there with Silicon Valley, disruption, early adopters, some of this language around.
Filter bubble, that kind of stuff.
Yes, exactly. A great example. Because what Ted is looking at is, look at what's happening, look what these companies are building, and look what the end result is. And it's repetitive, addiction-like, or maybe straight-up chemical neural addiction to these platforms.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we have been loath to move from a metaphor or simile like cigarettes to it is addiction. And I think this is putting me over the edge, honestly, in thinking about what this is. You and I, since we have worked digitally together on this company for a long time, have fought against this, what I would call the dismissive mode. I think I'm borrowing that from someone. I'm not sure who. The dismissive mode of the new, right? Of being, this is dumb, this is going to matter, no one cares. Because that is the enemy of creativity, change,
innovation.
Progress, innovation. Not all of that is good. Some of it is good and some of it is bad. That's just the way that it is. But I think I'm finally ready to be like, it's not just that TikTok and Instagram Reels aren't for me. I am wondering about if they should be for anybody. And in 50 years, are we going to have a smoking gun report from inside Meta, much like RGR Reynolds had in the 50s, about how bad this is for people and kids especially?
We're already getting it. The gun's already smoking.
Right. I guess that's right. And then, you know, he's talking about the relationship. I mean, one thing Ted cares about is the preservation, maintenance, and thriving of capital A art.
Yeah.
Which I think I care about that to some extent. I don't really care. I am more comfortable with capital E entertainment. The thing he said is like, what's happening is that distraction is eating it all. Like there's this fish info. It's not even infographic. Like it's an idea representation of the big fish of distraction eating the slightly smaller fish of entertainment, eating the slightly smaller fish of art. And my smell test of that feels about right. That feels about right to me.
Yeah, this is a piece I had been waiting for somebody to write. And it's not surprising that it's Ted Gioia. Like, folks, if you want to give money to one Substack, I am not sad about any of the dollars I have given to Ted Gioia over the last couple of years. He positions this as most of us, most creative people, think that what we're talking about is a competition between art and entertainment. Yeah. That's the old Facebook is offering entertainment, and so are books, and so books have to compete with Facebook, or books have to compete with the internet, like just to ground it in what the publishing conversation has been. He's like, no. It's not even as simple as just all of the ways you can be distracted are competing with art. It is this addiction. Addiction is the thing. The tech companies explicitly want us to be addicted to them.
That is the desired end result of most
like
digital media platforms. Not companies, because there are people there that care about art and entertainment. You know, maybe I'd throw our hat in that particular ring. We're not interested in addiction cycle or distraction cycle.
Right.
But the platforms are because, well, you say, why are they so interested in this?
Because that's what makes them money.
That's what
if
makes
you
them money.
Will not leave, if you can't leave the platform, or if you get twitchy when you're off the platform. And like, I hear this so much from friends with kids that like, man, when we were on vacation in a place that didn't have reliable internet, my kids were fine when we were doing activities, but they were real twitchy when we were sitting around without the TV on and their phones couldn't do a thing for them. And that twitchiness, like it's both habit, and habits can be broken.
It's like getting the shakes when you didn't get your Marlboro Reds.
Yeah,
it's so similar. It's wild.
It is. Right. It's not just a habit. That habit is connected to a reward system in our brains.
Right.
This is not the habit of just like, you know, I put my shoes on this way instead of this other way. It's a habit that is connected to like the deepest possible reward system that we have. And that dopamine hit from fast moving, colorful, bright, loud video is so compelling to our brains. And you just want more of it. And that's part of why you see like Reels and TikTok make it really hard to find a link and click a link to a thing that someone is talking about, because they don't want you to leave the platform.
They don't want you
to find that thing. They want you to watch more videos. Bumble and Hinge and Tinder and all the dating apps don't want you to meet somebody. They want you to keep swiping to look for somebody. And their algorithms are built to do it. Like, there's been a lot of work looking at like a lot of like halfway exposés of the TikTok algorithm, especially, that get to here's how this algorithm works to keep you engaged. But no one that I've seen has gone straight to the heart of it, of like, and here's why they want to keep you engaged. And it's because if they can get you addicted, they will have you. The most compelling sentence in this piece is something where he says, like, that there's no end to this because this is a like, dopamine and addiction to dopamine are a biological process. If you are used to a certain amount of dopamine and you stop having that much dopamine, you want to find a way to go get it. That's the way addiction functions. And that there is a certain place at any kind of addiction where the thing that gave you pleasure starts causing pain. This is part of opioid addiction. It's part of gambling addictions. Like, fill in your addiction here. It causes pain, but you still have to pursue it. And I think we, as you were saying, like, it's time for a real conversation about, like, this isn't, it's not bad kind of like cigarettes. It is bad. It's bad. Yeah. These things are bad. Yeah. We might have had good things come out of them, but they are fundamentally ill. The ill intent is part of it. It's built in. They want you to keep using the thing in a way that is addictive. Twitter, especially now, not about expanding public conversation, not about creating, you know, democratic levels of community or anything. That can be part of it, but, like, the fundamental goal of a platform is to keep you continuing to use the platform. And the ways that they're doing it are accessing deep biological processes and reward systems that, like, cannot be fought with willpower. They can't.
People know. And, like, there's not a good way to smoke one cigarette for most people, right? Like, there's not, maybe you could do things to, you know, limit your exposure, like if you want to dip your toes into some of this stuff. But if you've had the experience of getting on one of these apps and scrolling for a while and you look up and more time has gone past than you thought, notice that, right?
Mm-hmm.
Notice when you're just sitting around and your hand wants to reach for your phone. And why? Is it because you want to do that? Or has it become there's some unidentifiable feeling you have that is the thing to do right then to make that feeling go away? Because that's not even about desire. That's not even about you wanting to do something, right? That's being in a addiction pattern. And I don't know, you know, and I'm careful because I don't want to get into a dismissive mode either. I'm not conversant enough in some of these places to have an opinion, but some of them I am.
Yeah.
And one of them, like the clickbait journalism, you know, the end result of journalism in this is the clickbait, which is just a bunch of clicks and you're down the rabbit hole of, like, you know, 9 celebs you can't believe look like that anymore. And that leads you to another one of those. Those have been around for a while, but the secret sauce of the TikToks and the Instagram reels is you just swipe. It's just a flick of the thumb. Yeah. The clickbait, you have to at least click on something. You have to do something else.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, it's largely passive.
And that is really, really surprising. I wonder what's next for this.
And I think, you know, Joya is not just like being a buzzkill for the sake of being a buzzkill, which would be valid here. This is a thing we should be concerned about simply because we should be concerned about it. But I think this is a slippery slope that is legit. The slippery slope is often, you know, just a, you know, false way to stop an argument or to stop a conversation. But what happens when people spend most of their free time just swiping passively through things that are created to keep them swiping passively? And the people who create those things are rewarded for generating something that successfully keeps people swiping passively is that there is less incentive to create something that is genuinely entertaining or genuinely artistic. And there's less, I don't know, space available from consumers, readers, viewers to engage with those things because they're not as, that they don't ring these dopamine bells that a TikTok reel does. You know, like last week I sat down to watch The Zone of Interest, a very weird, very quiet 2-hour movie. in my house without my phone. And I thought about like how many people in these weird moments of this movie where it's uncomfortable and it's intended to make you uncomfortable. How many people watching this at home are reaching for their phones? How many people can't, how many of us can't watch TV for half an hour or sit at dinner? Like, I know Bob and I talk about this every time we go out to dinner. Like, do you think the couple behind us who are both on their phones are miserable because they're on their phones? Or are they on their phones because they're miserable? Or do they even know? Like, you have gone to a, you've gone to a public place. You have made an effort to go somewhere with a person you have some kind of relationship with, and you're spending your time staring at your phone. Why is that? What is happening? And I don't think it's the thing most people want to be doing, but they are doing it anyway. And that is classic addictive behavior.
Yeah. And when's the last time you heard someone say, you know what? I spent a really fun 45 minutes scrolling today.
I felt great about myself and the state of the world afterwards.
Like the term doom scrolling. Yeah. I mean, we have a term like, if that has come across your sort of internal consciousness as something that you may do or experience, that's fascinating. That's a fascinating observation. And there's a noticing your thoughts element to this. Mm-hmm. And it is, I do also want to not mistake the tools for the uses of those tools, because people use their, they say, well, don't look at your phone. I think there's good, there's ways you can use your phone that are great. I do believe that. But they also have enabled some ways and platforms and tools that are not great within that thing.
The phone as the tool is not inherently bad. Yeah. I think these platforms are at this point.
Because you can read, you know, Faulkner on your phone.
Yeah.
And have a healthy relationship with your phone.
Or
but I think
FaceTime your parents who live 1,000 miles away and maintain a relationship in a way that you couldn't, you know, you had to write letters in the past.
It's in the water amongst the teachers and parents of my kids to think about managing a relationships early with tech. We say devices, but we really mean of modes of engagement with those devices. Yeah. Because if I'm watching a Pavarotti documentary with my family on Netflix, that's different. It just is. I mean, that is different, which we've done. It's great, by the way. And so it's like, I think there's a world in which the nuance of this kind of argument gets lumped in a way that people will find hard to hear and resist if it's like, you just, you know, let's go farm together and use telegrams. Because that world's gone too. Like, there's not going back to, and we're going to communicate through handwritten letters. I mean, you can individually, but if you want to be a part of the world, you're not going
to
do that.
Yeah. We need to have functional relationships to this to the technology like our phones, because those are not going back in the bag.
Right. It's like, it's going to be like cigarettes. It's going to be like sugar. It's going to be like trans fats. It's going to be like, acid rain. I mean, I think it's throw them in the mix with all those sorts of things. Mm-hmm. Like, wait a minute. This thing that giant corporations have done because it serves their bottom line interests. And people who listen know this is not the language I use generally, right? This is not my modus operandi to sort of talk about this. So maybe you can hear in my voice a different level of seriousness or concern. A lot of times it's okay. And sometimes you get vaccines out of these giant corporations profit seeking. Mm-hmm. And sometimes you get acid rain, and sometimes you get feeling like crap because you just spent 45 minutes scrolling on your phone and you don't know why, and you feel worse than when you started. And that's real. And that's a real thing.
Yeah. I think the impact on our humanity of these things is the primary concern. It's Joya's primary concern in this piece. It's our primary concern as humans who are talking about this, as anybody who like thinks about how the internet is made and cares about the state of humanity and our relationships or your kids, as you were saying. We become a little less human when the thing that we're doing is mindlessly scrolling through stuff, especially when there are other people all around us most of the time. Like, not for nothing, we have more ways to stay connected than we ever have before. And we also have a global loneliness epidemic. And I don't think that those things are unrelated to each other, because we're not using these tools primarily to form genuine connections. They don't offer themselves to us that way. They offer themselves as distractions that become addictive. And whether that means that you miss like what could be just like a pleasant, warm interaction with the person standing in line behind you at the grocery store because you're scrolling and they're scrolling, or you're missing out on bigger parts of your life, this is something that we all have to pay attention to. And it is connected to art, which I also think is central to humanity. Like, TV is getting worse. Movies are getting worse. And it's because they have to compete with these distracting forms of engagement. Like, Netflix has become crappier. And it's kind of because, like, the stuff that's easy to watch while you scroll, Netflix is explicitly creating TV shows that they know you can watch while you scroll and not miss anything. Like, this is not the kind of art that we want to be focusing on in the world. I don't think anybody who cares about, like, the quality of our art or entertainment or books want that. But it's become the thing they have to do if they want people to watch shows on Netflix. They got to give them shows they can engage with while they also scroll. And that's just, it's a shame. I am concerned about this in a way that I am not very often capital C concerned about, like, things that happen in culture and technology. I think most of the time, as you were saying, we have, like, this is interesting, use it with moderation. Let's watch how this stuff goes.
Let's keep our minds open and our hearts ready, but also...
Yeah.
You know.
But this is... We're in a place now where we've had these platforms long enough to see that it's not just that they can be used for harmful things, it's that primarily they are turning out to be harmful. And I don't think that was the starting intention necessarily, but that's the way it has gone. The incentives are so messed up.
They are messed up. And I think that one thing that he doesn't engage with, but I think matters, and it doesn't fit neatly into sort of this dopamine cycle. It's not just the consumption part of it, it's the creative part of it too. Mm-hmm. That people spend a lot of time posting stuff. There's like two cycles. There's a consumption cycle and the creation cycle. You post your Instagram things, you get likes. Those are dopamine hits too.
Yes.
Those are coming from the other side. So the platform gets to play both sides of the addiction fiddle. That's not right.
Yeah.
They get to play both sides of the transaction, right? They get to addict you to approbation in the forms of likes or shares or view counts or whatever. There's a reason your stats are available to you as an individual user, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
And then they get it from the consumption side too. And that is extremely difficult to think about. I think this conversation is useful, much like the science and also public discourse on alcoholism was useful in saying,
yes,
it's no longer a moral, like, we scold you because drinking is bad. It's actually, there's something else going on here that's beyond
for you. Yeah.
Just sort of like bootstrappy self-improvement. Just be better. Just don't do that because you shouldn't. It's a more insidious, nefarious, and harder to shed cycle.
It's incredibly, it's hard to shed by design. And like, if you want to be out of it, almost the only way to be out of it is to take the apps off your phone. If you don't ever want to get sucked down, or to fill your life with enough other things that these distractions are not as compelling, I think those are really the only options. Like, the willpower way is not the way that most of us are going to avoid just becoming doom scroll zombies, which is now what these platforms want us to be. And it's really unfortunate. I want to continue watching great movies. I want to watch great TV shows. I want to be moved by great art. I want to read great books. And people are going to have less time to spend making those things when they're spending their time making TikToks. And like, a lot more time goes into making a 30-second TikTok than 30 seconds. And that's time that can't be spent. The opportunity cost of being a creator on these platforms and like what it costs these creators, but also what we don't get as people who want to engage with art because creators are making TikToks instead of other things is just terrible.
Yeah, and in a way, it's a rational decision from the creator point of view, right? Well,
sure.
I can't pay my bills if I want to make videos, or that's increasingly more difficult to do, or just the digital advertising dollars are somewhere else, or I get direct payments from somebody else. I think we're going to need a Silent Spring kind of book here. And here's my public call to Adam Grant to go dark Adam. Adam Grant's Stock and Trade is not making you feel crappy. It's, here's studies about 20-year-olds at Purdue that is interesting for you in the workplace. But we need to, maybe they're happening out there. Are there college campuses full of behavioral psychologists with people on phones? There have to be. About their happiness levels, about their ability to perform, memory, they have to be happening, right? I haven't seen these come out yet, and I look for them. I'm sure they're out there. Like, Dopamine Nation is one that he includes here. I'm going to read this book.
Me too.
And it's Finding Balance in the Age of Indulgence, which is a turnoff for me, and it's all on my side. I want the Malcolm. I do want one of these airport books that had that summarizes. This is what we need. This is what could be good, right? Mm-hmm. Every now and again, we need one of these Unsafe at Any Speeds by Ralph Nader to wake people up. And there's a reason I still remember those, and maybe you recognize them too. Like, they matter ultimately.
Yes,
but it's time for one of these.
Right. There's a reason we still know what Silent Spring is, like 40, 50 years since its publication.
That's right.
I think it's time for that, and for us to just write, like, this is now a structural problem, and I'm starting to see that. Like, I've read a lot of the books about attention. I'm starting to see those authors saying, like, there are individual habits you can change. I think I told you, or maybe I talked about it on a recent show, like, when I've got a couple minutes between a call now, I'm trying to develop this habit of, like, not picking up my phone in between things, but, like, there is a jigsaw puzzle and I'm going to go spend 5 minutes doing it. That's not how I want to spend my downtime forever. Like, I would like to not need that sort of in-between tool, but it's a good way to, like, not just do the reflexive reach. And I'm starting to see authors say, we can have these individual solutions, but we need some structural solutions. And I want somebody to come out with a big call.
I don't even know what that looks like. I mean, with cigarettes, like, there's some things where, I mean, I guess you have to legislate at the app level somehow. Anyway,
right.
We can get
the way the cigarette industry was regulated changed after that. And this industry is barely regulated. So, like, that any kind of more serious regulation would be great, but something that goes to address these things and combined with public awareness that moves individuals to either get off these platforms or significantly change the way they interact with them. Like, also just on a human level, like, I think in general, as a human in the world, the ability to be uncomfortable is a superpower. And that's what all the, like, distracting you from the things that make you uncomfortable, even if the thing is just, like, 2 minutes with your thoughts while you wait in line at the grocery store, that's the thing that the platforms are preying on. And so it is becoming increasingly valuable, increasingly a superpower to not be a part of that cycle, or to minimize your engagement with that cycle, because it leaves your mind available for other things. It leaves you space to engage with people and art and to make stuff and to have original ideas. And all of that is what we need as people. Like, I don't want to do the doom scrolling, and we all do it. We all have our moments of, like Bob and I will joke if we're visiting family, especially, or it's like, wow, that was a long dinner. Let's sit down and dissociate for a couple of minutes. And it's never three.
No.
You know?
And even if it is three, you don't feel any better.
No.
Yeah.
I should go take a walk instead. And bring on the days where I
bring the New Yorker print with you. Like, I mean, there's stuff.
Right. On the days I make that choice, I feel a lot better. So, like, we're talking about this and we're calling for things, and I think our listeners know, but I want to be really clear, like, we're calling for it not because we're above it, because it impacts us too.
Yes.
And we don't want to feel it either. We don't want to see the people that we care about feel it.
I think we better delay Frontlist Foyer for another week. Also, there's a Lee and Low Diversity in Publishing story that we will talk about next week. It was on the agenda today. We weren't long. I don't want to try to cram it in 3 minutes. It's worth looking at. Erica wrote for us a really good piece on the deep dive too that I hadn't seen when I did a little linking to it in Today in Books. I think there's a couple of sides to the story, but we'll dig into that next week. Bookriot.com/listen. You can find the show notes, everything we talked about here, the Patreon at patreon.com/bookriotpodcast, Better Living Through Books, Today in Books, Deep Dive, all kinds of stuff. If you're into the BREU, the Book Riot, the BRPEU, the Book Riot Podcast Extended Universe, as I'm taken to calling it now.
Sure.
Thank you so much, everyone, and we'll talk to you soon.